controversial Venezuelan leader, let it be known that his goal was to establish a hemispheric counterweight to the U.S.-dominated Organization of American States, OAS. Unlike the OAS, the new organization, the 33-member Community of Latin American and Caribbean States, CELAC, included Cuba and excluded the United States and Canada. Chavez proclaimed the summit the most important political event in our America in 100 years or more. Cuban President Raúl Castro was even more grandiose, anointing the new organization as potentially the biggest event in our 200 years of semi-independence. The new organization was intended to further lessen U.S. influence in the region. "We are sentencing the Monroe Doctrine to death," announced Nicaraguan President Daniel Ortega, referring to President James Monroe's 1823 assertion that the Western Hemisphere was the United States' sphere of influence. "It's great to be here in the land of Bolivar," Paraguay's President Fernando Lugo told an interviewer, in reference to Simón Bolívar, the lionized Caracas-born 19th-century liberator of South America. "Bolívar's dream is becoming concrete little by little," he added. Even U.S. allies like Presidents Felipe Calderón of Mexico, Juan Manuel Santos of Colombia, and Sebastián Piñera of Chile showed up for the inaugural event. The United States was further isolated when Obama attended the Summit of the Americas in April 2012. Meeting in the Colombian coastal city of Cartagena, leaders of the Western Hemisphere, emboldened by the Caracas gathering, openly defied the United States in a way that was unprecedented and invigorating. Debate centered on two issues that were fundamental to hemispheric relations: the exclusion of Cuba and the U.S.-backed war on drugs. Whereas the United States had previously set the agenda and dictated the terms of the discussion, that was no longer the case. President Calderón described the change, the frankness with which the issues were discussed, as radical and unthinkable. An article on the summit in the Jamaica Observer was headlined, "Summit Shows How Much Yankee Influence Had Waned." Latin American leaders made clear that they had had it with U.S. efforts to ban Cuban participation, a stance defended only by the United States and Canada. Members of the Bolivarian Alliance of the Americas, ALBA, a group of Latin American states that had formed in 2004, said that they would not participate in another summit meeting without Cuba. Santos dismissed U.S. policy toward Cuba as anachronistic and ineffective, and demanded Cuban inclusion, as did Brazil's Dilma Rousseff, who also indicated she would no longer attend without Cuba. Though defending U.S. policy, Obama noted that the discussion reminded him of gunboat diplomacy and Yankees and the Cold War. Some of the leaders also challenged the United States on its drug policy, which Obama again defended despite his own admitted youthful indulgence. Guatemala's president, Otto Pérez Molina, declared the 40-year-old war on drugs a failure and called for decriminalization. Santos noted that Colombia's own successful efforts to reduce coca cultivation had only resulted in a production spike in Peru and Bolivia, and that drug violence, while lowered in Colombia, had now spilled over to Mexico, Guatemala, and Honduras. And in an act of unprecedented defiance, in August 2012, Ecuadorian President Rafael Correa outraged U.S., British, and Swedish authorities by offering political asylum to Julian Assange. Assange had holed up in the Ecuadorian embassy to avoid extradition to Sweden, where he was under investigation for sexual assault. He feared that, once in Sweden, he would be extradited to the United States. The British were so disturbed by Ecuador's actions that they threatened to storm the Ecuadorian embassy and arrest Assange, which would constitute a flagrant violation of international law. In June 2012, Paraguay's right-wing forces fought back with a parliamentary coup in that impoverished nation, impeaching left-leaning President Fernando Lugo, whose moderate program of land reform threatened Paraguay's wealthy landed interests and multinational agricultural corporations. The International Herald Tribune went out of its way to comment on the fact that the United States, which once called the shots in Latin America, had had become irrelevant to political processes in the region. However, by its refusal to join hemispheric neighbors in condemning the action, the United States was effectively sending a signal of support. Not so other Latin American nations. Argentina, Brazil, and Uruguay voted to suspend Paraguay from the South American Free Trade Association, Mercosur, and invite Venezuela to join as a full member. Paraguay had been blocking Venezuela's membership in the trade organization, which operates by consensus. Despite repeated setbacks in the Middle East and Latin America, U.S. military strength remained unchallenged. As Chalmers Johnson revealed years ago, the United States maintains its global hegemony not through an empire of colonies, but through an empire of bases strung across the planet. Journalist Nick Terse found it impossible to ascertain the exact number, but found evidence to indicate that the total was over 1,000. And the cost of maintaining this vast network was tens of billions of dollars. In 2010, the United States still had 124 bases in Japan, 38 of which were in Okinawa alone. South Korea still had 87. In 2012, anthropologist David Vine confirmed that the total number of bases, despite the closure of 505 bases in Iraq, was still more than 1,000, and the annual cost of maintaining that global network of bases and 255,000 overseas troops was around $250 billion. Forces were being shifted, in large part, from mammoth Cold War-style bases to widely dispersed smaller bases known as lily pads that could serve as jumping-off points for highly mobile U.S. troops. Such bases were proliferating in the Middle East, Asia, and Latin America. And the U.S. military was rapidly expanding its presence in Africa. China, America's new global rival, had no overseas bases. The nation faced a quandary. The post-Cold War world refused to play by its rules. Neither its unprecedented military strength nor its overwhelming economic power translated into an ability to bend history in the ways U.S. leaders desired. The world seemed to be spinning increasingly out of U.S. control. Nothing symbolized this more than the rise of China, with its 1.3 billion people, booming economy, almost 40% of which remained state-owned, and authoritarian Communist Party-controlled political system. China's economic growth, while extraordinary under any circumstances, stood out even more starkly when measured alongside U.S. economic stagnation and decline. In 2011, China's per capita GDP, though still only 9% that of the United States, was double what it had been 4 years earlier, and Chinese leaders were projecting another doubling in the next 4 years. China had already replaced Japan as the world's second-largest economy, having jumped remarkably from number 7 in 2003. Indicative of future prospects, the Urban Land Institute and Ernst & Young reported that China devoted 9% of its GDP to infrastructure, more than triple the portion invested by the United States. China's new economic clout in October 2011 came into sharp relief when Europe asked China for help in saving the euro, inviting it to invest tens of billions of dollars in Europe's Emergency Stability Fund. China was, in effect, being asked to assume the role long played by the United States as the world's financial leader. China had already bought up key economic assets in Europe, which had become China's largest trading partner. Although China balked at investing so heavily at a time when Europe's economic situation remained so precarious, the significance was unmistakable, especially coming just weeks after Timothy Geithner's advice to a gathering of European finance ministers had been so rudely dismissed. The New York Times aptly titled its front-page article, "Advice on Debt? Europe Suggests U.S. Can Keep It." Believing that recent developments had proven the superiority of its economic and political systems to those in the declining West, China had been asserting itself in other ways as well. Most troubling to U.S. leaders and Asian neighbors alike, China was rapidly modernizing its military. Defense spending had tripled to $160 billion in the course of one decade. It was building a blue water navy, It added warships, submarines, fighter jets, and offensive missiles, and armed its first aircraft carrier. The military modernization would not have been so alarming to China's neighbors if China had not also aggressively pressed claims to disputed oil, gas, and mineral-rich islands and territories in the East and South China Seas. China's claims to the South China Seas alone conflicted with claims by Vietnam, Indonesia, the Philippines, Malaysia, Taiwan, and Brunei. In the East China Sea, tension remained high between China and Japan. Relations were punctuated with a series of confrontations that aroused passions on all sides. The rhetoric heated up. In October 2011, China's widely read and stridently nationalistic Global Times wrote threateningly, "If these countries don't want to change their ways with China, they will need to prepare for the sound of cannons. We need to be ready for that, as it may be the only way for the disputes in the sea to be resolved." China's military buildup, aggressive pursuit of energy and raw materials, and bullying of its weaker neighbors gave the United States the opening it was looking for. Instead of helping resolve the disputes amicably, U.S. leaders decided to exploit regional tensions and exaggerate the Chinese threat. In hyping China's military buildup, U.S. officials neglected to mention that China had in the past two decades substantially decreased the size of its army, the number of planes in its air force, and its fleet of submarines, and that the proportion of its GDP devoted to defense spending was in line with that of Japan, South Korea, and Taiwan. The United States appeared ready to use this manufactured crisis not only to reassert U.S. hegemony in Asia and justify a bloated, if shrinking, defense budget, but to halt the overall decline in U.S. power and prestige. With all the trappings of a new Cold War, the United States set out to contain China, economically, militarily, and politically, and pressed other Asian nations to assist in the effort. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton had thrown down the gauntlet with an article in the November 2011 issue of Foreign Policy magazine, bluntly titled America's Pacific Century. The article began, "As the war in Iraq winds down and America begins to withdraw its forces from Afghanistan, the United States stands at a pivot point." The dramatic change she heralded would be a substantially increased investment, diplomatic, economic, strategic, and otherwise, in the Asia-Pacific region, which included the Indian Ocean as well as the Pacific. Obama reinforced that message during his 8-day trip to the Pacific later that month. He informed the Australian Parliament, "In the Asia-Pacific century, the U.S. is all in. I therefore made a deliberate and strategic decision. As a Pacific nation, the United States will play a larger and long-term role in shaping this region and its future." "The United States is a Pacific power, and we are here to stay," he said, even predicting the downfall of the Chinese Communist Party. Impending cuts in U.S. defense spending, he assured the Aussies, will not, I repeat, will not, come at the expense of the Asia-Pacific. Proving his point, Obama announced that the United States would deploy 2,500 Marines to Australia in what amounted to the first long-term U.S. troop increase in Asia since Vietnam, reversing decades of steady decline. The increase would come on top of the 85,000 troops the United States already had in the Pacific, where 7 of its 11 aircraft carriers and 18 nuclear submarines were based. From Australia, Obama went to Bali, Indonesia, for the annual meeting of the 10-nation Association of Southeast Asian Nations, ASEAN, and became the first U.S. president to attend the larger East Asia Summit meeting. During the summit, Obama joined with other participants in confronting Premier Wen Jiabao over China's South China Sea claims. Obama pledged to strengthen ties with each of the participants and announced that the United States was selling 24 F-16 fighters to the Indonesian Air Force. He also surprised attendees by unveiling plans to dispatch Secretary of State Clinton to Myanmar to repair U.S. relations with that Chinese ally. Clinton was in the Philippines when Obama visited Australia. From the deck of a U.S. warship in Manila Bay, she signaled U.S. support for the Philippines' position in the South China Sea dispute. The United States had previously conducted joint naval exercises with the Philippines in June, and then did so with Vietnam in July. In September, the United States and Vietnam signed a Memorandum of Understanding on Defense Cooperation. The once bitter enemies even discussed possible U.S. naval access to the port at Cam Ranh Bay. Vietnam announced a 35% increase in defense spending in 2012. The United States had also divulged plans to station some of its littoral combat ships in Singapore. In December, the Philippines relaunched its biggest and most modern warship, a U.S. Coast Guard cutter. A Thai newspaper described the scene. As a Navy brass band played, Roman Catholic priests sprinkled holy water on the deck of the newly repainted warship, equipped with anti-aircraft guns, and a newly refurbished surveillance helicopter on the flight deck. Three Navy planes flew past, and officials broke a bottle of sugarcane wine on the bow as the ship went into commission. Officials also unveiled the Philippines' first troop and tank-carrying ship, and announced plans to purchase another Coast Guard cutter and fighter jets from the United States. In July 2012, with tensions flaring anew over the disputed islands, President Benigno Aquino III announced plans to purchase helicopters and other aircraft that could be used in military confrontation. Malaysia, too, showed off its enhanced military strength by displaying its newly acquired submarines. Malaysia has extensive oil and gas resources in the South China Sea. Admiral Robert Willard, commander of U.S. Pacific Command, indicated that efforts were also underway to fortify strategic ties with India to counter China's growing strength. India loomed large in the effort to contain China. Despite the imposition of sanctions on India following its May 1998 nuclear tests, in March 2000, Bill Clinton became the first U.S. president to visit New Delhi in 22 years. The New York Times described the visit as a love fest. George W. Bush went much further to bolster U.S.-India ties. After 9/11, he lifted all sanctions and later established a military alliance. In 2006, he signed a nuclear cooperation agreement with India, despite the fact that India was a non-signatory to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, NPT. Though limited to civilian uses of nuclear power, this was a clear violation of the NPT, and one that freed India to enhance its nuclear weapons program. The United States first had to gain approval of the 45 nations that comprised the Nuclear Suppliers Group, a consortium that the United States had established following India's illegal 1974 test. The administration bullied and wheedled international approval of the president's ill-conceived nuclear deal with India, charged a Times editorial. Ron Summers, president of the United States-India Business Council, called it a tectonic shift in relations between the two countries. It was also a major setback to non-proliferation efforts. Obama accelerated the strategic partnership, hosting the Indian Prime Minister at his first White House state banquet, pushing ahead with implementation of the nuclear agreement, despite strong opposition from some of his own advisors, and solidifying the military alliance established by Bush. Hillary Clinton declared it the joint responsibility of the United States and India to determine the course of the world. Obama's three-day visit to India in November 2010 strengthened the partnership. In November 2011, India's Defense Ministry approved a massive $12 billion military modernization program, which would include the Indian Army's largest expansion on its border with China since the 1962 war. The Center for Strategic and International Studies estimated that India would spend a total of $80 billion by 2015. India had already been the world's leading arms importer between 2006 and 2011. To counter China's growing naval power, India planned to spend $45 billion on 103 new warships over the next 20 years. India's elevated levels of defense spending seemed even more objectionable in light of its persistent widespread poverty and the enormous gap between rich and poor. A survey of 73,000 households in nine of India's poorer states, released in early 2012, found that 42% of children under the age of 5 were malnourished. The problem of malnutrition is a matter of national shame, acknowledged Prime Minister Manmohan Singh, who continued to spend lavishly on unneeded weaponry. The United States had no patience for those who vacillated, as Japanese Prime Minister Yukio Hatoyama learned when he tried to renegotiate the agreement to relocate the large U.S. Marine Air Base within Okinawa from Futenma to Henoko. Obama insisted that Japan abide by its commitment, despite fierce opposition by the Okinawans themselves. When Hatoyama caved to U.S. pressure, his government collapsed. Hatoyama's successor, Naoto Kan, learned his lesson. In late December 2010, Japan announced a shift in military doctrine to de-emphasize the threat from Russia to the North and shift resources to combating China and North Korea. Japan's special defense forces would also cooperate much more closely with the United States, Australia, and South Korea. The new National Defense Program guidelines called for increasing Japan's submarine fleet from 16 to 22, adding several new fighter jets, and cutting the number of tanks to create a more mobile force that could quickly dispatch troops to deal with crises in the China Seas or Korea. In December 2011, Japan announced purchase of some 40 Lockheed Martin F-35 stealth fighter jets at a cost estimated at between $6 and $8 billion, despite the desperate need for funds to rebuild after the previous March's devastating earthquake, tsunami, and nuclear accident. Chinese leaders accused the United States of trying to encircle them, insisting that it was the United States, not China, that was projecting military power in the region. China, they maintained, had tried to peacefully resolve its disputes with its neighbors. They expressed outrage over Obama's approval of $5.8 billion in arms sales to Taiwan, after having approved $6.4 billion the previous year. Congressional Republicans demanded even more, to which a senior administration official replied that, compared to Bush, Obama had provided twice the amount in half the time. The People's Daily, the official Chinese newspaper, informed the United States that it could forget about Chinese cooperation on other global issues. American politicians are totally mistaken if they believe they can, on the one hand, demand that China behave as a responsible great power and cooperate with the United States on this and that issue, while on the other hand, irresponsibly and wantonly harm China's core interests. The Chinese were also angry over other perceived slights, including Obama's decision to meet with the Dalai Lama after choosing not to do so earlier in his administration when he was trying to improve relations with China. The United States had also let slip that it was developing a new war strategy for Asia called the air-sea battle concept. Although highly classified, mention of it first appeared in the United States' 2010 Quadrennial Defense Review. It was designed as a way to coordinate U.S. naval and air forces to counter China's growing ability to disrupt the United States' high-tech weapons and communication systems, and thereby interfere with its ability to project its military power in a conflict. U.S. military leaders pointed to the threat from China's anti-access strategy, which would limit U.S. ability to militarily aid allies. The fear, according to Andrew Krepinevich of the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments, CSBA, was that such Chinese action would give it control of sea lanes in the Western Pacific. Speaking at the U.S. Air Force Academy, Secretary of Defense Robert Gates said that such threats appear designed to neutralize the advantages the U.S. military has enjoyed since the end of the Cold War, unfettered freedom of movement, and the ability to project power to any region across the globe by surging aircraft, ships, troops, and supplies. Chinese leaders understood that it was actually their shipping that was being threatened by tightened U.S. control over the South China Sea, through which tankers carrying most of China's oil imports passed. They pledged to resolve outstanding regional differences peacefully, but they also made it clear that they would defend their interests. In a December address to China's Central Military Commission, President Hu Jintao told the Navy to make extended preparations for warfare. Also included in that calculation was war with the United States. When CSBA, one of the defense think tanks that had been gaming large-scale warfare with China for the Pentagon, issued a report on the topic in 2010, the PLA, China's People's Liberation Army, went nuts, according to a U.S. official who had just returned from Beijing. An internal report prepared for the Marine Corps commandant warned that an air-sea battle focused Navy and Air Force would be preposterously expensive to build, and if used in war between the United States and China would produce incalculable human and economic destruction. In pushing the confrontation with China, the United States and its Pacific allies were playing a very dangerous game. Their economic dependence on China made them particularly vulnerable to retaliation. As the holder of over $1 trillion in U.S. Treasury bonds, China had the U.S. economy by the throat. Could the United States really afford to risk a hostile relationship with its biggest creditor? And, complicating matters further, China had replaced the United States as the biggest trading partner of all the Asian nations. In 2004, the United States had been the largest trading partner of the 10 nations that comprised ASEAN. By 2011, China was the first, and the United States had fallen to fourth. In December, Japan and China announced that their currencies would convert directly into each other, obviating the need for each to buy dollars before converting them into the other's currency. Such a move not only would expand trade between the two nations, it represented an important step toward making the yuan an alternate reserve currency to the dollar, as China desired. Undeterred, the United States persisted in the effort to bolster its economic position. In fall 2011, it formed a free trade group, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, with allies in Asia, Latin America, and North America. It did not invite China to join, which made Fred Hu, the former chairman of Goldman Sachs in Greater China, who now chaired the Primavera Capital Group financial advisory firm, wonder, how can you have a credible trade organization if you exclude the biggest trading nation? In a parallel military move, the United States Pacific Command invited Russia and India to participate in a major naval exercise off Hawaii in June 2012. China was not invited to join. U.S. hegemonic pretensions remained lofty, but U.S. ability to police Asia and the rest of the globe was constrained by the dimensions of its budget crisis. By 2010, the U.S. was spending $1.6 trillion over revenues in its $3.8 trillion budget. The shortfall was borrowed largely from China and Japan. Debt service alone cost $250 billion. The military budget, including black operations, intelligence, foreign military aid, private contractors, and veterans' benefits, totaled over $1 trillion. Christopher Hellman of the National Priorities Project calculated that the U.S. actually spends over $1.2 trillion out of its $3 trillion annual budget on defense when all military and security-related expenses are factored in. That figure approximately equaled what the rest of the world spent. Even during the height of the Cold War, the United States spent only 26% of the world total. As Congressman Barney Frank observed, we have fewer enemies and we're spending more money. U.S. military spending consumed approximately 44% of all U.S. tax revenues. Maintaining bases cost approximately $250 billion. Hiring the Pentagon's vast army of private contractors, which, according to the Washington Post, totaled 1.2 million people, cost almost as much. New and costly high-tech weapon systems added to the burden. Did all this spending make Americans safer? Frank commented, I don't think any terrorist has ever been shot by a nuclear submarine. In 2011, the Obama administration announced plans to reduce the Pentagon budget by at least $450 billion over the coming decade, with additional cuts of $500 billion looming if Congress failed to meet other revenue goals. But Obama and Leon Panetta, who had moved from CIA to defense, made clear that the restructuring would not impinge upon the U.S. shift toward Asia. They rejected proposals to cut the number of aircraft carriers from 11 to 10, and planned to increase investment in the long-range stealth bombers and anti-missile systems considered essential in combating China, as well as armed drones, cyberspace systems, and rapid deployment aircraft. In June 2012, Panetta notified a conference of defense officials from 28 Asia-Pacific nations that the United States would rebalance its forces. By 2020, 60% of U.S. naval forces would be in the Pacific, and only 40% in the Atlantic, a substantial shift from its 50-50 split in 2012. U.S. forces will include, Panetta explained, 6 aircraft carriers in this region, a majority of our cruisers, destroyers, littoral combat ships, and submarines. In case anyone missed the point, Panetta outlined some of the United States' spending priorities. We are investing specifically in an advanced fifth-generation fighter, an enhanced Virginia-class submarine, new electronic warfare and communications capabilities, and improved precision weapons that will provide our forces with freedom of maneuver in areas in which our access and freedom of action may be threatened. We recognize the challenges of operating over the Pacific's vast distances. That is why we are investing in new aerial refueling tankers, a new bomber, and advanced maritime patrol and anti-submarine warfare aircraft. And if that weren't sufficient, Panetta had the gall to remind listeners, including officials from China, the Philippines, Japan, Korea, Indonesia, Laos, Cambodia, and Vietnam, that over the course of history, the United States has fought wars. We have spilled blood. We have deployed our forces time and time again to defend our vital interests in the Asia-Pacific region. He insisted, with a straight face, that stepped-up U.S. efforts in the region were not aimed at containing China. Even the New York Times noted that few in the audience said they believed that. Indonesia's foreign minister voiced the views of many who resented U.S. pressure to choose sides, a seeming throwback to John Foster Dulles's 1950s attacks on nations that refused to choose sides in the Cold War, commenting, "What worries us is having to choose. We don't want to be put in that position." U.S. plans to militarize the region were coming up against other obstacles as well. Some of America's Asian allies were confronting the same budgetary constraints that were impeding U.S. efforts. In May 2012, Australia, where Obama had kicked off his Asian tour a few months earlier, announced cuts in defense spending of 10.5%, or $5.5 billion over the next 4 years, which, according to the Australian Strategic Policy Institute, would represent the lowest percentage of gross domestic product since 1938. The Sydney, Australia, Morning Herald warned that events in Canberra and Washington raise serious questions about the ability of the alliance partners to give effect to their grand pledges to each other. On the Australian side, it is stunningly clear what's happened. The Gillard government has chosen to reduce Australia's defense effort to its feeblest in 74 years. The government weighed its priorities, and defense came in at the bottom. For the United States, with the Pacific off the table, defense savings would come in part from cutting the size of the Army from 570,000 to 490,000, and lowering force levels in Europe. Joining Panetta at the Pentagon in early January 2012, Obama declared, "We're turning the page on a decade of war. We'll be able to ensure our security with smaller conventional ground forces. We'll continue to get rid of outdated Cold War-era systems so that we can invest in the capabilities we need for the future." While cutting defense spending, pulling combat forces out of Iraq, and beginning the drawdown in Afghanistan represented a welcome retreat from the hyper-militarism of the Bush-Cheney years, they did not represent the sharp and definitive break with empire that the world needed to see from the United States, and that Obama had been encouraged to pursue by the man who had engineered the end of the Soviet Empire. Mikhail Gorbachev. Gorbachev had pressed Obama to pursue the kind of bold initiatives that had allowed Gorbachev to change the course of history. America needs perestroika right now, he said in 2009, because the problems he has to deal with are not easy ones. Gorbachev called for ending the kind of unregulated free market policies that caused the global economic downturn and perpetuated the gap between the world's rich and poor. The United States, he warned, can no longer dictate to the rest of the world. Everyone is used to America as the shepherd that tells everyone what to do. But this period has already ended. He condemned the Clinton and Bush administrations dangerous militarization of international politics, and urged the United States to withdraw from Afghanistan as Russia had done over 20 years ago, when Gorbachev inherited a similarly disastrous and unpopular war. As 2012 dawned, the world was in extraordinary flux. U.S. global power had eroded, opening the door to an exciting array of possibilities, some fraught with dangers of their own. Recognizing the extraordinary upheaval that rattled ruling elites across the globe in 2011, Time magazine had just named The Protester its Person of the Year. The spark had actually been ignited in December 2010, when Mohamed Bouazizi, a 26-year-old Tunisian street vendor, having been humiliated by police one too many times, set himself on fire. That simple and desperate act sparked a massive popular rebellion in Tunisia that overthrew the 23-year rule of Zine El Abidine Ben Ali. The sight of ordinary Tunisians standing up fearlessly to their police state rulers struck a chord with millions who had suffered their own indignities at the hands of corrupt, dictatorial regimes that, more often than not, had been backed and armed by the United States. The movement spread quickly to Algeria, Egypt, and across the Arab world. The WikiLeaks release, beginning in February 2011, of 250,000 U.S. diplomatic cables poured fuel on an already burning fire. Protests in Libya, Syria, Yemen, and Bahrain were soon spiraling out of government control. Opposition to government and banker-imposed austerity swept across Europe, most prominently in Spain, Greece, Italy, France, and Britain. Chinese citizens defied their government officials in protests against corruption and inequality. Russians rose up against vote fraud and Vladimir Putin's autocratic rule. Japanese expressed outrage over government and power company deception in the aftermath of the Fukushima nuclear disaster. And in the United States, the Occupy Wall Street movement brought desperately needed attention to the tremendous and ever-growing gap between the wealthiest 1% and the rest of the population, the 99%. The Pew Research Center reported in January 2012 that two-thirds of Americans believe that strong conflicts existed between rich and poor, a 19% increase since Pew's July 2009 survey. 30% felt there were very strong conflicts, a 50% jump in 2.5 years. This was no surprise, given the fact that the net worth of the median American family had dropped 39% in 3 years, from $126,400 in 2007 to just $77,300 in 2010, according to the Survey of Financial Resources issued every 3 years by the Federal Reserve. Those without high school diplomas saw their net worth plummet by 54%. In 2012, Joseph Stiglitz calculated that the combined $90 billion wealth of the 6 Walmart heirs equaled that of the bottom 30% of Americans. The movement also raised profound and troubling questions about U.S. priorities in the aftermath of the financial meltdown. Budget cuts, though often ill-conceived, had forced Americans to reconsider the wisdom of the imperial project itself. At a time when unemployment soared, infrastructure decayed, and social services were decimated, could the United States really afford to maintain its vast global empire? Was it really in the U.S. interest to police the planet? Should the United States ever again invade countries that posed no threat to the American people? The prospect for reform at home also brightened. The movement, hearkening back to the workers' rights, social justice, and anti-war struggles of the 1930s and 1960s, ignited the imagination of millions across the country, especially America's youth. Suffused with a sense of utopian possibilities for the first time in decades, Americans began to wonder what a fair, equitable, and just society might look like. No longer would they tolerate the inordinate power and influence the wealthy exercised in dominating all spheres of public and private life. And the impact of the Occupy movement was felt far beyond its own ranks, as its egalitarian and redistributionist sentiments reshaped political discourse in the United States. The broadening link between renewed U.S. activism and democratic strivings on a global scale augured well for the future. But monumental problems exist that demand attention. Global warming threatens the future of life on the planet in ways that only nuclear war had done previously. It is already melting the Arctic and Antarctic ice caps, raising ocean levels, causing floods and droughts, expanding the reach of deadly diseases, and ruining global food and water supplies. The United States itself reels from the effect of record temperatures, disastrous hurricanes, floods, forest fires, and droughts rivaling the Dust Bowl of the 1930s. Nor has the nuclear threat by any means abated. The danger of nuclear proliferation, even nuclear anarchy, continues. Nuclear arsenals remain far in excess of the megatonnage that experts believe necessary to trigger a life-extinguishing nuclear winter. And despite Obama's professed commitment, the prospects for substantial reductions, let alone complete abolition, seem bleak. In what would presage a remarkable turnaround if it continues, even Barack Obama began showing faint signs of returning to the transformational figure he had appeared to be during the 2008 campaign. Spurred by the Occupy Wall Street movement's success in getting out its message, continued Republican intransigence, economic stagnation, budgetary constraints, and tumbling approval ratings, by late 2011, Obama appeared to be regaining some of his old dynamism. Traces of populism crept into his speeches. He openly embraced ending the Iraq War and cutting defense spending, even though both developments had been forced upon him. Was there a chance that he might be undergoing a Kennedy-esque road to Damascus conversion and realizing how poorly American militarism and imperialism had served the American people and the rest of the world? The prospects looked dim, and his Fort Bragg speech and willingness to sign the extremely dangerous 2012 Defense Authorization Bill were not encouraging. What had become apparent was that the real hope for changing the United States, for helping it regain its democratic, egalitarian, and revolutionary soul, lay in U.S. citizens, joining with the rebellious masses everywhere, to deploy the lessons of history, their history, the people's history, which is no longer untold, and demand creation of a world that represents the interests of the overwhelming majority, not that of the wealthiest, greediest, and most powerful. Building such a movement is also the only hope to save American democracy from the clutches of an ever-expanding, ever-encroaching national security state. Such tyranny was a threat that America's revolutionary leaders understood very well. When a woman asked Benjamin Franklin in 1787, after the Constitutional Convention, "Well, doctor, what have we got? A republic or a monarchy?" Franklin responded with words as timely today as when he uttered them. "A republic, madam, if you can keep it." Chapter 15 2012 to 2018 How the Unthinkable Became Thinkable Again. On March 1, 2018, Russian President Vladimir Putin threw down the gauntlet to the United States and its European allies. In his annual State of the Nation address, he unveiled a dizzying array of new weapons and delivery systems, with capabilities never before achieved by Russia or anyone else. He did this in a way that was neither boastful nor threatening. Rather, he sternly warned the U.S. and its allies to back off policies that were pushing the world closer to war, a war that would result in unspeakable tragedy for all of mankind. The timing was not accidental. Tensions between the United States and Russia had been escalating at an alarming rate. Conflicts in Syria, the Baltics, and Ukraine threatened to boil over into war between the world's two great military superpowers. The crisis on the Korean Peninsula, provoked by President Donald Trump's belligerent response to North Korea's nuclear bomb and missile tests, had the world on edge. Trump's promises to tear up the nuclear deal with Iran only increased global angst. In January, nuclear experts had moved the hands of the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists' Doomsday Clock to 2 minutes before midnight, judging the world closer to nuclear Armageddon than it had been since the 1950s. The Bulletin's Science and Security Board warned, "To call the world nuclear situation dire is to understate the danger and its immediacy." Just the week before, Secretary of Defense James Mattis had announced that after almost two decades of treating the fight against terrorism as the nation's top defense priority, the U.S. was switching its top priority to counting the Russian and Chinese military threats. And then in February, the Trump administration released its highly provocative nuclear posture review. Putin's response shocked military experts around the world. Putin acknowledged that Russia had been on the defensive since the collapse of the Soviet Union, which brought the loss of 23.8% of Russia's territory, 48.5% of its population, 41% of its GDP, 39.4% of its industrial potential, and 44.6% of its military capability. Russia, as we have outlined earlier in this book, and as Putin again reported, had become an economic basket case, dependent on the IMF and World Bank for survival. With life expectancy and standards of living plummeting, and chaos tearing the fabric of society apart, the West exploited Russian weakness and did as it pleased around the world. In 2001, the United States announced that it was withdrawing from the Anti-Ballistic Missile, ABM Treaty, which Russia considered the cornerstone of the international security system, since its signing in 1972. The treaty had been premised upon the understanding that if one superpower's defensive shield became increasingly impenetrable, the other would counter by beefing up its offensive missile capabilities, leading to a perpetual arms race. Alexei Arbatov, the vice chair of the Defense Committee in the lower house of the Russian parliament, called the U.S. withdrawal an extremely negative event of historical scale. Russia objected vehemently, but, Putin regretted, its appeals fell upon deaf ears as the U.S. opted to pursue ultimate unilateral military advantage in order to dictate the terms in every sphere in the future. In June 2002, the U.S. officially withdrew from the ABM Treaty so that it could begin deploying an elaborate global missile defense system with installations in Alaska and California, as well as Romania. The Czechs eventually opted out of the missile defense program, but another system in Poland nears completion. The U.S. installed new launching capabilities in Japan and South Korea, and deployed 5 cruisers and 30 destroyers ominously close to Russia's borders. Putin dismissed U.S. assertions that the purpose was to protect against a limited missile attack launched by Iran or North Korea. The U.S. goal, Putin contended, was to intercept all of Russia's missiles, leaving Russia effectively defenseless. Experts understood that such an otherwise porous system might prove effective in defending the U.S. against a limited Russian counterattack, if the U.S. launched a debilitating first strike against Russia. Putin charged that aside from the 2010 New START Treaty, the U.S. had resisted Russian appeals for arms control negotiations and adopted a more aggressive nuclear strategy. Seeing what was developing, in 2004, Russia embarked on a program to circumvent America's missile defense system, which had been designed primarily to destroy strategic arms that follow high-flying ballistic trajectories before they hit their targets. Now Putin was telling the world that his nation had developed 5 new weapons that could make U.S. ballistic missile defense systems obsolete. They included a terrain-hugging nuclear-powered cruise missile of effectively unlimited range, which independent Russian military analyst Alexander Goltz said would be a gigantic achievement. An RS-28 Sarmat ICBM with a payload of 15 missiles and an almost unlimited range to replace the Soviet-era SS-18s. A hypersonic cruise missile that would travel at blinding speeds. A submarine-launched Status-6 nuclear-armed, nuclear-powered underwater torpedo. And an RS-26 avant-garde hypervelocity glide vehicle that can fly into space on a rocket traveling 20 times the speed of sound and evading missile defense systems. Russia had already leaked plans to build a drone submarine that would act like an underwater nuclear torpedo and target coastal cities with a radioactive cloud that would render them uninhabitable. Designs for such a pilotless submarine could be traced back to the 1960s. The new weapons system, called Status-6, first came to light when Russian television cameras, reporting on a November 9, 2015 meeting in Sochi between Putin and a group of generals, showed a page of a briefing book that revealed the torpedo's existence. The torpedo, the document revealed, would be launched by submarine and have a range of 5,400 nautical miles. It would damage the important components of the adversary's economy in a coastal area and inflict unacceptable damage to a country's territory by creating areas of wide radioactive contamination that would be unsuitable for military, economic, or other activity for long periods of time. Putin didn't mince words. He warned that Russia would consider a nuclear attack on any of its allies to be an attack on Russia itself, and would respond immediately. "I hope everything that has been said today will sober any potential aggressor," he said, adding, "No one listened to us. Listen to us now." Some people were definitely listening. Goltz said that all the weapons experts he had spoken to were in shock, as was I. RAND Russia expert Edward Geist admitted he was still kind of in shock over the nuclear-powered cruise missile. "My guess," he said, "is they're not bluffing, that they've flight-tested this thing." Dmitry Trenin, director of the Carnegie Moscow Center, warned that "Relations with the U.S. are at a point where the only thing that must be worked on every minute of every day is that this does not lead to a collision." Nuclear expert James Acton of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace reminded those aghast at Russia's new capabilities that Russia, even without these weapons, has the capability to reduce the U.S. into a pile of radioactive soot. Geist warned, "They're sending us a message that they are not okay with our U.S. missile defense posture. They're willing to go full strangelove on us." The Washington Post reported that Putin's confrontational tone appeared in part to be a response to the Trump administration's more hawkish approach to nuclear weapons. But Russia's grievances went much deeper than that. Putin stated defiantly, "And to those who in the past 15 years have tried to accelerate an arms race and seek unilateral advantage against Russia, have introduced restrictions and sanctions that are illegal from the standpoint of international law, aiming to restrain our nation's development, including in the military area, I will say this. Everything you have tried to prevent through such a policy has already happened. No one has managed to restrain Russia." Russia's comeback was indeed remarkable, considering how low it had sunk when Putin took office on New Year's Day 2000. For a while, American prospects hadn't seemed too much brighter. It was only 14 years earlier, in 1986, that Gore Vidal had written his Requiem for the American Empire, in which he dated the empire's demise to September 16, 1985, when the Commerce Department officially announced that the United States had become a debtor nation. The empire, he noted, had lived to age 71, but had been in ill health since 1968. He traced the empire to 1914, when the U.S. replaced London as the center of world finance. The empire had been sunk, in part, by wasteful spending on the military, which had been justified by the fanciful depiction of the Soviet Union as a fearsome enemy. "Not since the invention of the Wizard of Oz," Vidal wrote, "have American publicists created anything quite so demented as the idea that the Soviet Union is a monolithic, omnipotent empire with tentacles everywhere on Earth, intent on our destruction, which will surely take place unless we constantly imitate it with our war machine and its secret services." Vidal envisioned an alliance between the U.S. and USSR as the erstwhile Cold War rivals' only hope of fending off the emerging challenge from China and Japan. In an essay 2 years later, he disparaged the Americans and Soviets as the two klutzes of the Northern Hemisphere, each unable to build a car anyone wants to drive. The American Empire, however, got a new lease on life on December 26, 1991, when the Soviet Union, which Vidal aptly described as a second-world country with a first-world military capacity, came to an abrupt end, leaving the still-standing United States as the global colossus, the unchallenged hegemonic power on the world stage. Looking back from 2004, leading neoconservative strategist Charles Krauthammer, who passed away in 2018, chose the American Economic Institute's AEI annual Irving Kristol Lecture as the appropriate forum for elucidating what this had signified. And then it ended with one of the great anticlimaxes in history. Without a shot fired, without a revolution, without so much as a press release, the Soviet Union simply gave up and disappeared. It was the end of everything. The end of communism, of socialism, of the Cold War, of the European wars. But the end of everything was also a beginning. On December 26, 1991, the Soviet Union died, and something new was born. Something utterly new. A unipolar world dominated by a single superpower, unchecked by any rival, and with decisive reach in every corner of the globe. Krauthammer's triumphalist vision, first presented in his September 1990 Henry M. Jackson Memorial Lecture, appeared in Foreign Affairs with the title, "The Unipolar Moment." He dismissed those who foresaw and welcomed a post-Cold War multipolar world, instead happily anticipating that the U.S. would be the single pole of world power for decades to come, because it was the only country with the military, diplomatic, political and economic assets to be a decisive player in any conflict in whatever part of the world it chooses to involve itself. However, he feared the U.S. would be entering a time of heightened, not diminished, threat of war. The threat would not come from a rival superpower. It would come from small aggressive states armed with weapons of mass destruction and possessing the means to deliver them. The best hope for safety in these abnormal times, this era of weapons of mass destruction, he concluded, was American strength and will to lead a unipolar world, unashamedly laying down the rules of world order and being prepared to enforce them. Leading neocons in and around the George H.W. Bush administration, Dick Cheney, Paul Wolfowitz, I. Lewis Scooter Libby, Zalmay Khalilzad, Richard Perle and Albert Wohlstetter brainstormed and outlined what the foreign policy for such a muscular, militarily enforced unipolar world might look like. According to their report, not only would the U.S. not allow a rival to emerge that could challenge U.S. global hegemony, it would not allow a rival to dominate any region whose resources would be sufficient to generate global power. The military would have to be so imperious that it could deter potential competitors from even aspiring to a larger regional or global role. The U.S. would preemptively block any country from attaining weapons of mass destruction, and it needed to develop the capability to simultaneously fight wars against Iraq and North Korea, while stopping a Russian incursion into Europe. In March 1993, someone leaked this new defense planning guidance to the New York Times, setting off a tsunami of criticism and forcing Cheney, Wolfowitz, and the others to publicly walk it back. But the neocons weren't through. In 1997, they formed the Project for a New American Century, PNAC. In 2000, the Supreme Court, to its everlasting shame, defied the popular vote and installed George W. Bush as president. PNACers filled the new administration's ranks and immediately began promulgating their worldview. 1 week into the Bush presidency, Los Angeles Times reporter Robin Wright accurately described the corrosive unipolarity. The premise of the new doctrine is that the U.S. can do pretty much what it wants because its sophisticated democracy makes it politically and morally superior to the rest of the world, and sometimes even exempts it from international norms and treaties. 8 months later, 9/11 gave them the new Pearl Harbor they fantasized about. Within a month, the U.S. had invaded Afghanistan. A year and a half later, it was Iraq's turn, and the neocons began openly celebrating the American Empire. Krauthammer didn't wait for the crushing of Saddam Hussein's Ba'athist regime to marvel at America's unparalleled might. He published an essay in late 2002 in which he revisited his 1990 embrace of unipolarity and admitted that he had underestimated the vastness of U.S. domination. "Nothing has ever existed like this disparity of power. Nothing," he bellowed. Kosovo had been good, but the invasion of Afghanistan was a thing of true beauty, confirmation that the U.S. was far and away the greatest hegemon in all of history. There would be no more hesitation, no more concern with international legality, no more obsession with exit strategies. In 1990, he had written that unipolarity could last 30 or 40 years, which seemed bold at the time. But now that projection seemed rather modest, because the unipolar moment has become the unipolar era and could go on indefinitely. "The choice is ours," he concluded. To impiously phrase Benjamin Franklin, "History has given you an empire, if you can keep it." In 2003, neocon triumphalism was unbounded. Talk of empire filled the air. Neocon strategists debated which countries were in line for regime change. Iraq, Syria, Libya, Iran, North Korea, Lebanon, Somalia, and Sudan made the lists. Commentary editor Norman Podhoretz also threw in Saudi Arabia, Egypt, and the Palestinian Authority for good measure. But the euphoria proved ephemeral. Defeating the Iraq regime was easy. Governing was not. In September 2004, Arab League head Amir Moussa declared, "The gates of hell are open in Iraq." It took Charles Krauthammer 2 more years, but eventually he too got it. In late 2006, he penned an obituary for the unipolar era. He announced that U.S. unipolarity had peaked in 2005, and now the U.S. was past the apogee of hegemony. The unipolar era had turned back into the unipolar moment, and even that would soon be at risk. The Bush debacle took an enormous toll on U.S. leadership and prestige. The declension that began under George W. Bush continued, more slowly, under Barack Obama, only to gain new momentum in the early unorthodox presidency of Donald Trump. On January 18, 2018, Gallup released the results of a poll showing that median approval of U.S. leadership across 134 countries had plummeted by 18 percentage points in the year since Trump had taken office, dropping from 48% in Obama's final year to a new low of 30% under Trump. Disapproval of U.S. leadership jumped 15 points to 43%, 7 points higher than disapproval of Russia and 13 points higher than China. The sharpest decline in approval of U.S. leadership, by 25 points, came in Latin America, where disapproval jumped by 31 points to 58%. The drop was also especially steep in Europe and Canada, led by a 51-point decline in Portugal. Germany, whose international approval ratings the previous year had trailed the U.S. by 7 points, now came in first with 41%. China, which had trailed by 17 points, registered at 31%, 1 point higher than the U.S. And Russia, which the U.S. had led the previous year by 22 points, was now only 3 points behind. In February 2018, former NATO Secretary General Javier Solana echoed the growing realization that multipolarity is back, and with it strategic rivalry among the great powers. He noted that the re-emergence of China and the return of Russia to the forefront of global politics are two of the most salient international dynamics of the century thus far. Solana observed that during Donald Trump's first year in the White House, the tension between the United States and these two countries increased markedly. As the U.S. domestic political environment has deteriorated, so too have America's relations with those that are perceived as its principal adversaries. The process of creating